Hi, everyone, and welcome to The Contrarians with Adam and Adir, the only pod that takes you behind the scenes and gives you the inside word on the world of tech and growth from the insiders. I'm Adam Schwab, co-founder of Luxury Escapes, journalist and angel investor, and I'm joined by my great mate, Adir Shiffman, executive chairman of Catapult Sports and serial investor. In this week's Contrarians, we talk about Dan Andrews' resignation, the fallout from Nick Bolton Magellan fiasco, what's happening at Premier Investments, and our special guest, Gavin Appel. So welcome, Adir. Episode number seven. Ratings keep going up. Hopefully we're knocking off Scott and Cara soon. So how was your week?
Everyone keeps telling me this is like the All-In podcast, but without the egos. I don't even listen to the All-In podcast. You know, I did an interview with Jason Calacanis, who's part of the All-In podcast, way back in the day on his This Week in Startups when Catapult was pretty young. Wow. And so he's a polarizing guy sometimes, but I've had a really good relationship with him. Yeah. Let me tell you something that happened to me this week that I think you'll find very interesting, because, you know, we spoke the other week about this gig economy and protecting workers. So I was out of milk and I did the millennial.
You're always running out of milk.
Am I?
You gotta buy extra milk.
Oh, you're not wrong. I buy milk and then it goes off, and, you know, my daughter only wants to drink Zymel. Anyway, I can give you lots of domestic problems, but you're probably not interested. And
not
so,
really, no.
And so I did something that you would frown on, which is I did a millennial. Well, you are a millennial, but we like supermarkets. But I thought, I'm just going to order. I think Uber Eats can deliver me milk.
Yeah.
So I go and order, and since I'm ordering, I order some other things from the supermarket, and my order is like $50. Nothing's on sale from Uber Eats, so you probably wouldn't do it. But
that's why I don't use it, because you get no special.
No, I can. I've read
the best part of shopping.
I'm good at reading your mind now, and so and so it comes, and so you know what I get charged for it? $50, but that's the regular price of groceries. Okay, I recognize the prices; it's regular.
Yeah.
Then there's like a $5 something fee.
Yep.
That gets wiped out because I pay my $10 a month.
So you've still got the Uber One.
Uber One. I told you I don't cancel any subscriptions. I'm subscribed to everything.
You know, Jody Oster actually came up with that, apparently. Or was
did
the,
she?
Yeah, that's what Tim, who's running Turo now, I caught up with during the week, who was at Uber for many years.
I'm not surprised she came up with it.
Yeah.
Basically, there's $5 of my $10 saved, and then there's another $5 on some other charge. Something is delivery and something service. So it comes, and what I'm watching is, as the person, it's a guy, as the guy's picking it off the shelves, it's appearing in my app that he's got this thing off the shelf, he's got this thing. So it is actually this person collecting stuff off shelves.
Pick it back.
And then he brings it to me, and it comes within an hour. Well, maybe it was half an hour in total. And so this is my question. Who the hell is paying this guy, and how is he getting paid? Like, it's a regular price of groceries. I'm paying $5 extra. I just don't understand who is paying the piper.
I presume the supermarket is paying some of its margin there, because they're not doing the specials.
Well,
so
we know what I think I ordered this from Coles Local.
Yep.
And so we know what Coles Local's gross margin is. It's probably less than 25%.
Oh, I thought 25, 30, because they got no specials dragging down the price.
Oh, okay. But even say 30. So on that $50, it's $15.
Yep.
So how much of that $15 are they giving to this person? Like, I just don't understand how the system works.
It doesn't make a huge amount of sense either. I agree. It's very it's confounding.
I'm going to try and use this as much as I can before they shut it down.
Yeah. Well, there's the Woolworths, obviously, owned by Milkrun now. They
yeah. Well, Milkrun couldn't work. Yeah. And so I just don't understand how this can work.
Yeah, I don't either. So let's get to our first story. Our first story was the surprise resignation of Victorian Premier Daniel Andrews, who resigned as Victoria's 48th Premier after 9 years in the job and a barnstorming election win in 2022. Andrews is both loved and viscerally hated by the Victorian electorate and ran a radical debt-funded nation-building program, including a popular level crossing removal project, as well as a number of other projects that ran massively over budget, including the Metro Tunnel, which was $5 billion over budget, and the Suburban Rail Loop, which could run as much as $50 billion over budget. Experts predict Victoria's debt will skyrocket to $171 billion by 2027, which is $70,000 for every Victorian household. Andrews also ran a more popular social agenda, including being the first Australian state to legalise assisted dying, but remains most controversial for his handling of the COVID-19 crisis, which led Victorians to being locked at home for longer than almost anyone else globally. So, Adir, you've had a lot of comments on Dan Andrews over the years. How do you view his resignation and his legacy?
My views on the pandemic were pretty widely reported. There were some things about that I thought were frankly terrifying, but it might surprise you to know, before COVID came along, I thought Andrews was likely to be a pretty good premier. Like, when he started removing level crossings. It is crazy that Melbourne in 2021 or 2020 was a city of 4 million people approximately and had all these level crossings all over the city. It's got to be one of the only major cities in the world that's running all these level crossings. And so I remember the opposition at the time whined about they didn't, they wanted it underground, not above ground. I thought it was all nonsense. And I thought he was shaping up to be quite, because he's a sophisticated individual, and I thought he was shaping up to be quite a good premier. There are other things that he did that I thought were great as well. Like, he was definitely an anti-racism champion. Absolutely. He was a really fight
against... Forget that 2018 election where the Liberals really fought on that anti-African, that African gang stuff they made up. And I voted for Andrews that election, regretfully so, but I voted for him for that exact reason.
I thought he had the potential to be this, you know, good leader. The problem that occurred, I think, is that his views about, this was my take on it, his views of what is appropriate to do as the leader of a democratic state are completely inconsistent with my views of the fragility of democracy. Like, democracy is not a natural state of affairs for human beings. A natural state of affairs is when you want something, go and kill the person that has what you want. I mean, that is the way human history has played out. And then we have this shining moment in history. I mean, everyone talks about it's a continuation of ancient Greeks. It's not, right? It's probably from the French Revolution. And we have this moment where we've found a way to build a society where we bring justice to a universe that is indifferent to the whole concept of justice. And that's a fragile situation. And so I felt like not only did I have massive issues with the lockdowns, but in fairness, nobody knew at the beginning what should be done. I never thought lockdowns were great, but I can be sympathetic for, there was a lot of panic at the start of this. There was a lot of panic. But trying to pass laws, which I referred to as thought police laws, where police or people that had been empowered by the government could arrest somebody on the belief that that individual might be contemplating breaching the laws. Like, to me, that just shows shutting parliament, disempowering the courts and an independent judiciary, not engaging with free press. Like, to me, that fundamentally was the undermining of the instruments of freedom and democracy. I know that sounds dramatic, but that was my core issue with this guy. And I felt like... this is what, you know, if you're an investor, like a fund manager, over the last few hundred years, we've gotten really good at like investing money, and finance has gotten more sophisticated. And we spoke about it last week. You end up with things like turning Katy Perry's songs into an annuity asset. I think what happens with democracy is that we've gotten really good at democracy, get practice and practice over years. Now we've got career politicians, which I oppose. I oppose the idea of career politicians. And so what happens is, at the pinnacle of that, you get Daniel Andrews, who is an unbelievably effective politician. And I don't think that's good for democracy, frankly. Yeah. That's my view on him.
I think you're right. I think you actually nailed that. I think he was so good at being the premier, this 300-person PR team, obviously, that was funded by taxpayers. And he was such a great media performer. He was the worst possible person to have at that time for Victorian COVID, because he could run ramshot over the media, and he obviously won those elections. And everybody talked about the Dan slide in 2018, and then he did very well in 22. But it was a weird situation that obviously everybody's vote counts for one. So you can absolutely viscerally hate Dan, like a lot of people, like probably 40% of people absolutely hate Dan. And probably 30% absolutely love Dan. But there's about another 25% that go, oh, he's probably better than the other guys. So he's hated by more people than love him. But the way one vote per person works is he kept winning elections because he was smart and he ran it well. So he got this guy who's incredible at winning elections, who could pay enough people off essentially via JobKeeper that they were sort of happy enough, and completely destroy the lives of other people who couldn't see loved ones pass away, who couldn't travel overseas, who couldn't travel interstate, who lost jobs because of his vaccine mandate. I'm not getting to a vaccine argument here, but people literally, and I was pro-vaccine, but people lost jobs as a result of a vaccine that didn't stop transmission. So completely wrong. So there was all, and he wasn't the only one to do that, but he made all these horrifically bad decisions and was able to because he was such a good politician. That was the unlucky part of Victoria, that copying this super talented guy who was so wrong.
I think there's a lesson. There's some lessons to take out of this, because he'll come and go. I mean, Victoria, I think the debt that Victoria is saddled with as a result of what I consider is a large number of very expensive, not well costed, not well, you know, thought through projects like the Suburban Rail Link, like that is a Victorian issue. And if I'm sitting in Sydney, I don't care about that issue. That's Victoria's problem. But I tell you the lesson that I think more broadly that we should take away from this. You know, I speak often about how much I love lots of what Gen Z is bringing to the world, but yep. I tell you something that terrifies me. they are too trusting of people in power.
Yeah.
And the reason that they're trusting is because, like, life has been
too good.
Good, right? There has, and we can generally trust people in power nowadays, but we should not trust people in power. The minute somebody comes into power, especially if they've been there for a while, you should think they're now in it for themselves. And I think Gen Z as a whole was way too supportive of the elected government and the decisions that they were making. And, you know, the idea that you would go into someone's house and arrest them for posting on social media, whatever, unless they're posting, let's go and, you know, kill people. Like Gen Z, as the young people of society, their natural inclination should be to hate people in power. Yes. That's my view.
Yeah.
And so I thought that was a problem. And the second thing, the takeaway for me is this. We should be very wary of people that seem like they're too good at politics, and maybe start electing some people who had careers before politics and are a bit clumsy at politics and have not tried to turn it into, you know, a cynical, sophisticated science. Because really what we want is are people that can stand up and just do what they believe to be right and do it transparently. I think the lack of transparency here was very cynical. And, you know, definitely Daniel Andrews was not just a seat warmer in politics. Like, there are lots of seat warmers.
Yeah.
He definitely went out and did things. I didn't like a lot of things that he did, but I think we should be generally much more cynical about the motivations of politicians.
The great Kaiser Soze move from Andrews was convincing the left that he was one of them. He hung out with Lindsay Fox, one of the richest guys in Victoria, all the time. Best mates or good mates with Luke Sayers, who's the ultimate capitalist. PwC now runs his own investment management firm, or investment advice firm. If you look at Dan Andrews' lowest moment was mid-pandemic when he locked down the housing commission in Flemington of people who couldn't speak English, mostly refugees.
Yeah.
A lot of Muslim people that weren't access to halal food, so they couldn't eat. Mm-hmm. This was effectively imprisoning people in their own home. So it was scientifically wrong. But even if it was scientifically right, with no notice, the rich guys could go to Portsea. Lindsay Fox could get to Portsea, no problem. But the poor guys in the housing commission, the most vulnerable people in the state, were imprisoned by apparently progressive left-wing. He wasn't a progressive left-wing leader. He was a cronyist capital leader. And Guy Rundle wrote, actually in Crikey a few days ago, Labor's become the party of capital by stealth and really a coalition. Who knows what the hell they represent now. But that was Dan Andrews' absolute lowest. Anybody who's progressive, who supported a guy who did that, I don't know how you can call yourself
progressive. That was literally found to be a breach of human rights.
They paid $5 million taxpayer money, got paid to these poor people. So you and I paid for Dan Andrews' mistake yet again.
Yeah, that's the cheapest mistake that we paid for. Yeah. I'm happy. $5 million mistakes.
Better than the rail loop, $50 billion.
Totally agree. So I think fundamentally, you know, there's lessons for democracy in general. You know, we can talk about this at a later stage. I've got some fears about democracy. Like, I think it's not in a very good place globally at the moment because too many people who want to seek power through politics have worked out how to play the system too well, and that is what's causing a lot of polarization. I mean, Andrews worked out that mainstream media was not the avenue through which he had to engage people. He focused on social media. Social media is bad for quality messaging. So I think democracy as a whole, like, we need to take societies need to take a step back and have a breath and say, how should we change things so we don't end up with the next 20 years of increasingly polarized politics?
And we'll go to a break now. We'll return with our next story on Magellan Financial.
Adam, I assume you've claimed the R&D tax incentive at some point.
God, it's the best thing I do all year.
That's very positive. Well, I also think it's fantastic. I mean, it pays back up to 43.5% of genuine R&D, and you can get a cash payment as well as a tax incentive. But the problem that I found is the process potentially can be a nightmare to manage.
Not only that, if you do it wrong, you actually get a really big fine from the tax office. So it's something that you want to be really careful with.
Agree. I mean, compliance is challenging. But the good news is our friends at Rimon Advisory specialize in managing the entire process and can also help claim everything that you're entitled to. They've been doing it for 12 years. I can say that I honestly actually use them for my startups, and their co-MD, Lior Steen, is really responsive in my experience. So you should go to their website, Rimon, that's rimon.com.au, where you can learn more, use their free calculators, and drop them a line. Now it's back to the contrarians.
For our second story, we go to the drama at Magellan Financial, which has been in the news almost non-stop since Hamish Douglass's implosion. Magellan's latest problem is a battle with corporate raider Nick Bolton. Bolton began his campaign back in March when he acquired 100 million options in the Magellan Global Fund, a closed-end strategy that listed in 2017 and was trading at an 18% discount to its underlying value. That discount has since narrowed to 12.5% after an aggressive market buyback. Bolton is trying to have the fund wound up, with proceeds being distributed to shareholders. And to get his resolution passed, Bolton needs support from 75% of unit holders. But Magellan's woes don't end there. Magellan Financial share prices crashed from $64 in February 2020 to only $9.28 now, with funds under management dropping from $73 billion to only $39 billion now. Bolton shot to prominence in 2006 when, as a 26-year-old, he banked a $4.5 million profit from an audacious campaign targeting toll road operator Bris Connections. So, dear, what do you make of this debacle at Magellan Financial, yet another one in the last couple of years, which has just been a tale of woe?
So do you know that I know Nick Bolton?
I don't, but it doesn't surprise me.
I've got the funniest way of knowing him. So back in the late 90s.
Oh, this is before he became a...
Way before.
He was about 12 back then.
I reckon I knew him when he was in his early 20s. I had a web hosting business with my brother, Gilly.
Yeah.
And Gilly ran it. I just did my usual, you know, strategic oversight. and it was a really nice business in the early days of web hosting. It was called Promise Web Hosting.
Yep.
Nick had a business that was, you know what his holding company was called? Australian Style.
That's right. That was what he used for Bris Connections. Yeah.
And like, it's very appropriate. The guy, like,
great hair.
Ultra stylish guy. Yeah. Actually a very intelligent guy. Yeah. And I found him very nice to interact with, just hard to pin down often. He worked out of these offices in Fitzroy Street in Melbourne, which is old building, beautiful building, huge. I think it might have been owned by his dad. And he was a partner, our main partner for the web hosting business. And we actually end up selling the business to him. It's not a huge transaction, but we ended up selling the business to him. So I actually knew him very well in those days.
He bought your business?
Yeah, he bought the business. Okay. And so I knew him very well. I mean, you know, his modus operandi is pretty straightforward. He basically finds a business that is very big and very well capitalized with lots of cash that is, for whatever reason, vulnerable in some way. He can exacerbate that vulnerability without having to spend insane amounts of money buying shares. And so with Bris Connections, well, I thought it was very smart.
He went incredible.
And bought a ton of options and basically, theoretically, could have sent that company into administration. And you know what is crazy about his modus operandi? Because that's smart, right? That's just being opportunistic. Some people might call it a vulture. I think I would call it opportunistic.
Yep.
What is crazy is he convinces everyone that he's their white knight and then goes and cuts a millions of dollars deal behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And so I think that's the issue that journalists had with him when they wrote about Bris Connections. I had heard, I don't know, I haven't spoken to him for years, but I'd heard that he had some run-in with some business and lost most of the money that he made out of that.
The Keystone with Jeff Wilson.
That's his new thing, right? But I don't want to say that names of companies were involved, but I'd heard that he ran into some trouble. And so he tried to do it with Magellan, who's obviously beaten down. It was pretty easy for him.
So what he's trying to do. So Magellan's got this fund that invests in stocks.
Yeah.
And the market, because Magellan's on the nose, nobody thinks they're
just a managed fund, right? You can put money in and it buys.
There's $100 worth of shares, and people are valuing the holding company at 75, essentially. So there's a bit of a gap. So especially Magellan, because people think Magellan's so inept, they're having a massive discount. So it's effectively burning money. So Bolton's saying, "Hold on, you guys are so terrible. Stop doing this. Just sell all the shares. You'll get $99 and give $24 back to unit holders who are suffering this massive discount."
And so, you know, we should say, like, this idea of these listed investment companies, which are basically fund managers that list on the ASX. And so, because one of the challenges when you put money into a fund manager is, like, how can you get your money back when you want it back? And often it's closed-ended. You can't even get your money back until maturity. Usually, if it's open, you can get your money back, but there's some fee that you pay and whatever it is. And so, you know, Jeff Wilson really was like an early guy that had this idea to, you can list these things. I remember his funds are called Wham. When I was a kid, let's say 20 or 20, I had like Wham shares and I wanted to ask a question and I rang up Wham and Jeff Wilson answered the phone.
That's pretty good.
So I thought that was impressive. I think, and So you know,
I used to be Sky Business with Jeff. I mean, I quite like him.
He's like, I think he's charismatic, and so he had this idea, which is there's two bits of genius to his idea of listing these things.
Yeah.
One is it's easy to get your money in and out because you can just sell and buy shares as if they're companies on the ASX.
Yeah.
The other beautiful thing is, when those when the investee companies that he owns pay dividends, he passes those dividends to people that own shares in a listed investment company, but he also gives them a chance to just reinvest, which is very tax effective. And so then he's endlessly growing the funds under management for these businesses. So it's a very smart approach. The problem is that, yeah, they trade often at a discount to the underlying value. And so lots of people have identified this problem. Jeff Wilson has identified, I think he got a business called Templeton, one of the Templeton businesses, and he managed to kind of incorporate that on the basis that it was running at a discount. So what Nick has done here is he's basically said, there's all these options that say you can buy shares in Magellan for a 6% discount to their net tangible assets. So, but the company is currently trading at a 14% or 15% discount when he bought them. And that means no one wants these options because they're worthless, right? Yeah. Why would I buy at 6% discount when I can buy, and they expire in May next year. Okay. And so he's like, well, exactly what he did with Bris Connections. Yeah. These are massively out of the money. They're trading, I remember Bris Connections were trading at 0.1 cents.
Yeah.
And so he's done the same with Magellan. He's bought up 10 or 15% of the options, got 100 people together and said, let's go and do an extraordinary general meeting and try and wind this thing up. Now, he's no chance of winding it up. He needs 75% of shareholders to vote in favour. The guy doesn't even have 5% of the stock because if he did, he wouldn't have needed the 100 people. Yeah. He could have done it himself, right?
True.
And so my guess is that this Key Bridge or whatever it's called that he does it with, which is backed by Anthony Catalano, who's got a bucket of money, right? Like, my guess is they call this green mailing, where you go and pretend you're a white knight but actually cut a deal. It's a harsh name for it. My guess is he wants to do something similar with Magellan. And what Jeff Wilson says Magellan will do is nothing and just ride it out until the options expire in May and just leave him holding the baby.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think it's very interesting. I mean, I know you feel you've got some views on Magellan more broadly, right? I mean, you don't feel sorry for them having had this, that this is getting done to them, do you? I mean, you're not a massive fan of Magellan's couple of years.
Well, I think there was always that cult of Hamish Douglas. Hamish Douglas was the co-founder. Hamish Douglas and Chris Mackay founded Magellan both. They met at Schroders or Bankers Trust, one of those great investment businesses in the 80s. They followed the Warren Buffett approach. And we've talked about celebrity CEOs before. Hamish Douglas was both a celebrity CEO and a celebrity stock picker. He thought he was Australia's answer to Warren Buffett. And Joe Aston has this great meme that he was running that, because Hamish used to claim he was the first into this, and Warren Buffett followed him into Berkshire and all this stuff. Yeah. So Hamish Douglas just basically lost the plot. So I think that we talk about celebrity CEOs as the greatest red flag for investors. Celebrity fund managers are almost worse. So they have a few good runs, a few lucky years. People think this guy's a genius. Clearly, remember he thought Uber was going to go bankrupt. Like, I'm no Uber fan, but Uber's not going to go bankrupt. It's worth $92 billion. So this is a guy who was completely, he had some real personal issues we won't talk about, which I think are well known about what happened there. But he got separated from his wife, and he said he wasn't, then he was. It was just an absolute disaster. He said he wasn't going to sell shares in Magellan, then he did. This guy is an embarrassment. And what I don't understand is why anybody would own a share in Magellan, the head co, because clearly people initially bought it for Hamish. He was proved to be a charlatan, and I wouldn't give him a cent of my money.
Well, they had good returns for a period of time.
Yeah, but you can have good returns for 2, 3, 5 years. It's irrelevant because ultimately they've certainly turned the other way. Then they lost a big mandate, St. James, a big mandate out of the UK. It's still got $39 billion. This is the $39 billion still in there, just people who are complete idiots who haven't taken it out yet. That is, to me, still one of the greatest shorts. Shorting Magellan Headco, that's what Nick Bolton should be doing, is shorting those guys. And this is a great indicator of how bad it is that this vehicle is trading at a 25% discount. This is how inept people think they are, that they're taking a 25% discount to their management.
Because the vote of this, effectively a discount to net tangible assets, is what you're saying is, I think the people running it are so bad, they actually detract from the overall value.
That's exactly what the market's saying.
Of the assets.
You are so stupid that I'm taking 25% off. I think you're going to lose me 25%, is what they're saying.
But in fairness, like LIC, these listed investment companies, LICs, they do go through cycles as an industry of being at a discount to NTA. Occasionally, some of them end up at a premium. The guys that I like best, I'll say openly because they're both my friends, are Mark Landau and Raphael Landau, L1. Who are really consistently smart and good operators. You know, they raised a big LIC. I think they They
six years ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, they took more than $1 billion.
Yeah.
It was a shocking first year or two for them. It tanked.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, I was just trying to buy shares as it tanked and running around kind of to my media contacts saying, they're not charlatans. Actually, they're really good, but you have to judge people on their performance through the cycle, not in one moment. Sure. They've obviously proven that they're really good operators. So they're trading at roughly their NTA. Very occasionally, managers will trade at a premium to NTA, but so even some of Jeff Wilson's vehicles trade at a discount to NTA. So I think it's harsh saying all of the discount to NTA is saying that they're morons. I think
some small discount, like 2-3% whatever.
Yeah,
25% discount. That's extraordinary.
Yeah.
Right? So if you got $100 million, you can. There's $25 million of value being removed because people think these guys are idiots. Essentially.
Agree. So my overall view on this is these things. Where, you know, these opportunistic, you know, financial engineering plays, which is what Nick, you know, seems to specialize in. I think, you know, it's a fun hobby and it's a nice way to make some money if you can. It's not really, I don't think, value accretive to the economy. We can argue about that, but like, I don't think it's value accretive to the economy. It's not a good, great use of time. And what I think is smart people should be thinking of smarter, more productive ways to generate money and generate some good for society. I don't think this will succeed, but who knows? Like, so Jeff Wilson is, I would say, almost the nemesis of Nick Bolton.
Yeah. They seem to hate each other.
Oh, across so many different things. Catalano is a power player. I mean, he's connected to Wieslitz. I don't think Wieslitz is involved in this, Alex Wieslitz, but, you know, these are serious players.
Yeah.
So this will be quite interesting to watch how this plays out, because Magellan, as much as I agree with a lot of your views on it, fundamentally, it's still a big player on the landscape. And so this is like a pretty big deal, this activity going on in this company at the moment.
Yeah. And we'll come back with our third story. This podcast is brought to you by Bowden Financial. Not only are Bowden one of the best wealth managers going around, but they also offer an incredible product called Group Employee Benefits. And when I heard about this, I immediately spoke to my CFO and told him, we've got to look into this. Group Employee Benefits is essentially a pooled income protection and life insurance policy, but at group level for all your team. These policies can cost individuals more than $10,000 every year. But by using Bowden, businesses can get a group policy, which ends up being far more cost effective, potentially as low as 1% of group wages. The real kicker is that the benefit to employees is so significant, they're much less likely to leave your business. It's like giving everyone a pay rise, but only paying a small fraction of it. If, like me, you're interested in learning more about group employee benefits, please call Bowden directly on 02-4937-0270 or go to bowdenfinancial.com.au to find out more. Now, back to the pod. And for our third story, it was revealed that UBS are working with Solilu's $3.9 billion Premier Investments business on a plan to break up the global retailer into four potentially separately listed ASX companies. According to brokers at Unified Capital Partners, Smiggle could be worth as much as $1.19 billion. Peter Alexander, which sells luxury sleepwear, could be valued at $1.59 billion, while the remaining apparel brands be worth almost $1 billion. With property holdings and stakes in Myer and Breville, that means the entire company, when split, could be worth more than $5.3 billion, compared to $3.9 billion based on current market value. There appears to be no great urgency on the deal, with UBS working until potentially mid-year to get it done. So, Adir, what are your thoughts on this potential breakup? Are you a fan of breakups? Where do you see it?
Well, it's luxury pajamas. You call Peter Alexander luxury pajamas. How do you know that you're wearing luxury pajamas? Have you worn them?
Nice. I'm not a luxury pajama guy.
I mean, you've sold me on a pair of Peter Alexander pajamas with that particular intro. I'm going to go out and get a pair and see. I'm going to report to you if I agree that they're luxury pajamas.
I'm more of a step one guy, as you know.
I know. On sale. Step one on sale.
Absolutely. Kind of at half price.
We can broaden to anything on sale, absolutely. I think is probably the way to characterize it. So what do I think about this? Do you realize what good businesses Smiggle and Peter Alexander are?
Incredible businesses.
They're actually unbelievable businesses. The fact that Solly bought Smiggle the way he did, when I don't think anyone really saw the potential of that business. I mean, both of those businesses Right. So I should say, like, some of the research I looked at is by a guy at Barrenjoey, the investment bank. His name's Aaron Nerozi. I think he's an excellent retail analyst.
Yeah.
He did a good, you know, analysis on this. If you look at both Smiggle and Peter Alexander, their EBIT margins, so earnings before interest and tax, their EBIT margins are north of 20%.
Yeah.
I mean, that is pretty impressive. Like, I am happy in a direct-to-consumer e-commerce business if I'm running 20 or 25% EBIT margins, like cash EBIT. Like, that's my target. Like, I'm happy about that. And so these are good businesses. They're opposite businesses. So Smiggle is all about an international growth story.
Yeah.
It's kind of ex-growth in Australia. It's footless countries already full of stores.
I think Wasolio, he makes his own. They generally make their own
that's
stuff.
Right.
They have contract manufacturing in China, so they're not paying a brand. They're the brand.
This is a direct-to-consumer retail business. Like, all right, it's got a lot of stores. Direct-to-consumer is fine with stores, by the way. Like, it's their stuff.
Warby Parker's directing.
Yeah, it's the same thing, right? And so they're an international expansion story, and Peter Alexander is predominantly a domestic story. So they're kind of different kinds of businesses. You know why he wants to break it up? Because he's got these... There's a weird conglomeration, I'll call it, of stuff like a stake in Myer, which he's obviously fixated on Myer as a business because of his for historical reasons.
Yep.
He's got this stake in Breville, which is a surprisingly good business. One of the great Australian success story businesses. Nobody, it's not sexy, but actually it's
great business.
Amazing.
It's on Toasters.
So he's got that. But he doesn't own them. He owns pieces of them.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he's got Smiggle and he's got Peter Alexander, which he owns, and Just Jeans and some other apparel businesses. Dotty, I think he owns in there.
It's in there. JJ.
JJ's with Just Jeans, right? And so
Deanna Moylan, who's a good friend of mine, runs Deanna and Dave are good friends of mine. And she's been one of the great sort of female retailers.
Yeah, he's got a long history of having really good general managers of the brands in there. And then he's got property, right? As you said, like he owns his head office and so it's a weird collection of stuff. And I think the view is maybe there's value to unlock by spinning out the really great businesses and getting higher earnings multiples for them on the ASX.
I think there's two points there. And we can talk about Solly himself in a second. I think there's two points. One is conglomerate structure. I don't like conglomerates. The problem with conglomerates is, and there's a few exceptions, Berkshire Hathaway, Wesfarmers is probably the two great exceptions because they've been such great managers of capital till Richard Goyder came and destroyed that at Wesfarmers, but we'll get to Goyder watch later.
This is not the Richard Goyder love in this podcast,
probably not.
Is it?
Well, not from me, maybe more from you. But the problem with conglomerates is, again, you get the multiple of the worst business. So you've got this great business in Smiggle and Peter Alexander. You've got a less good business, another one of the businesses, and you generally don't get the full value for all your holdings. So that's why it's not a great result, unless you can be Warren Buffett and get it just a great positive halo across the whole thing. So that's one thing. And I think the other thing to focus on is just how good an operator Solomon Lew has been. So he's not only is a great, I mean, there was some stuff at Coles Myer that wasn't great, but as a pure operator, certainly since the Premier days, he's an incredible acquirer of talent. So do you remember he got Mark McGuinness, when Mark McGuinness was, remember we talked about that sort of damaged...
Bruised fruit.
Mark McGuinness obviously had the issue at David Jones, but clearly was an incredible at Officeworks, did a great job at David Jones, did an unbelievable job at Premier. He's a great acquirer of talent. Richard Murray didn't go as well, but you can see what he was getting at there. But he's this great acquirer of fantastic managers. So he's really smart the way he hires good people. And he's just such a great... People say never buy a business from Solly Lew because you're paying... Solly Lew and Kerry Packer, two people you never buy businesses from, the late Kerry Packer.
Yeah.
And there's a reason, because he's just such a smart guy. He bought Smiggle and Peter Alexander, two of the best acquisitions in Australian history. He sells at the top of the market every time. Mm-hmm. He buys at the bottom. This guy is almost as good as they get.
But Brett Blundy is the only other retailer that I think is as good as him. I think, you know, you talk about talent. I think one of the motivations of this spin-off conversation might be, you know, there was some executive turnover at the top of the businesses recently.
Yep.
And I think it's hard to retain talent when you're running a business that is part of a broader conglomerate that has its own CEO. Yep. And I think maybe part of this is a way to keep high quality talent in Smiggle and Peter Alexander that could otherwise be looking for the next opportunity. I will say, like, Barrenjoey is not a fan of this breakup.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So one of the things that nobody talks about is, like, there are these negative outcomes of breaking up conglomerates as well. Yeah, dis-synergies, exactly. Which, by the way, I'm almost certain that is a made-up word. I know I see it written.
A real word. Real word.
Well, it's a real word now because people have just said, what's the opposite to a synergy? Like, I don't know. So like, three people in the world know what a synergy actually is, and now they've got this antonym which isn't even real.
I think synergy is the excuse you make for a bad acquisition.
Yeah, and so it's what, like, also analysts write to talk against breakups. And so, you know, like the arguments about dyssynergies in this that Barron Joey had is that they'll lose some buying power and they'll lose some centralised resources that they can share across the businesses. So, you know, the truth is, though, when you look at the way that these are analysed, like, it all just comes down to what earnings multiple are we going to use as our assumption for what these businesses would get if they were broken up? And the answer is nobody knows. It's like pretty close to a random number generator. And so no one knows if the breakup would be good or not until they actually go out in market and see what fund managers are going to be prepared to pay for these spin-offs. My guess is if they do it, I don't think it will happen. I think it might be a ruse for something else, but I don't know what that is. But I agree, you can't bet against Solly. But my guess is that, like, if it happens, what they'll end up doing is just what's called an in specie distribution. So they'll say to the shareholders of Premier, we're now spinning off Peter Alexander. Here's shares in Peter Alexander.
Absolutely.
And so that might be the way that they do it. But it's definitely one of the most intriguing things going on in retail at the moment.
I think we can just go back to first principles. So yes, you're right in terms of valuation. That will determine the short term. But if you look at what's the better fundamental business practice, and my view is, actually does make sense to split these businesses up. I generally hate conglomerates. I think they make no sense for investors. Your point on hiring great managers who want to run an entire business is totally right. I don't want to report to Richard Murray or whoever's running Premier if I'm a great CEO running Smiggle, which itself is a multi-billion dollar business. That doesn't make any sense. So I think, and it didn't work at Coles Myer, and since they broke that up, but there's still bits and pieces of the combined at Wesfarmers. I think the notion of having all these businesses under the one umbrella actually doesn't make sense. The conglomerate thing doesn't make sense. I think it fundamentally is right. Maybe the valuation, maybe there will be dyssynergies because you've got to hire a CFO at each one, you've got to hire an office for each one. So there are inevitably costs that creep in. But in the long term, that becomes part of the business essentially. And the business should perform better at a much higher return on equity over a longer period. So it should be a value accretive move in the longer
term. But the one flips, because, you know, this is a quirk of fate, this conglomerate, right? Like, Solly's got his private business, which is called Century Plaza or whatever called, and he went and grabbed this cash box called Premier and then did this incredible transaction to buy Just Jeans, which was hard-fought transaction, right? Like, it went through the takeovers panel and lots of things. It was hard-fought. But the truth is today, like, so Premier is a pretty amazing business. I think it throws off $250 million of net profit or something.
Yeah.
It's a very profitable business.
Yeah, sure.
It's got a lot of cash. I think it's got $300 or $400 million of cash in the bank. And so the alternative to breaking this up is to double down on the conglomerate structure and go and deploy that cash and buy the next thing.
Mm.
And like Brett Blundy, by the way, I think Brett Blundy, you know, he recently bought Best and Less,
which
I think he bought too early, to be honest. Like, I think it was not the right time to buy it. But the thing is, you can't bet against him either. And so I think you can give Solly or Blundy like a retail business with potential, and they will go and extract the potential out of that business. And so the other option here is to deploy that capital and just to double down on the conglomerate structure, which, you know, you're not going to like, but it's like, it's a decent plan B.
Yeah. And I think just a quick final point is whatever Solomon Lew's doing, you should do. So remember, he sold Coles just before the GFC to those idiots at Wesfarmers led by Richard Goyder. If I'm backing Richard Goyder or Solly, I'm backing the latter.
High bar, though, because you could say if I'm backing X or Solly in retail, I'm backing Solly, and you could put almost anybody into the X, and it would still be true.
But the delta between Goyder and Solly is pretty significant.
Very nice. We're talking about chasm.
And we'll be back with our friend of the contrarians, Gavin Appel, after the break. There are lots of digital agencies out there, but if you want to work with the best and get next level analytics data and even media mix modeling, just like the huge advertisers do, then you've got to speak to Ori and the team at Bench Media. Call them on 1300 049 498 or go to benchmedia.com. We're super excited to welcome our first ever friend of the contrarians onto the show, Gavin Appel, CEO and founder of Ignition Lane and one of the OGs of the Australian tech sector. Gav was the CTO of Hitwise, one of the first Australian internet superstars, and joined Experian after Hitwise was acquired by the Irish business in 2007. Gavin managed 900 people and led the product team at Experian before joining Paul Bassett at Square Peg as a founding partner in 2013. Gav then co-founded OneStack and later founded Ignition Lane, where he advises some of Australia's most exciting scale-up and startup.
So today at Ignition Lane, so I'm a startup advisor and tech investor now. Ignition Lane is an advisory business. We predominantly work with founders or CEOs looking to make that jump from startup to scale-up. So businesses sub 2 million ARR predominantly, growing to 10 million. It's when the founder's going from the Swiss Army knife, for those people listening who still know what a Swiss Army knife is, to having to build fundamentals, build the foundations of systems, processes, a true people and culture strategy, and the go-to-market to scale that business.
So how many people are usually in the business when you jump, when you sort of get appointed?
So some of the businesses have sub 10 people.
Yeah.
Others have 50 and above.
Okay.
So they can vary depending on the business. Predominantly the founders that we work with are solo founders, where it's a lonely job being a solo founder, and they have deep subject matter expertise of the problem they're solving, but they've never scaled a business before. And so they may or may not be plugged into the startup ecosystem. They may or may not have raised external funding. They may be bootstrapped, and they're looking for somebody to partner with who have been there, done that. And with our team's experience across startups, scale-ups, corporate and venture capital, we can provide like that secret weapon as a partner to the founder to scale.
I mean, we should say, like, this is not a sponsored basically, we like it, what he's charge. Saying is yeah. What he's saying, unfortunately, is actually true about 100%. How good he is. So I've seen it because I brought you into Globe Reviews and you did amazing product stuff. I think one of the travesties of this country is that people do not. Not enough people know about Hitwise. I mean, Hitwise, when was it sold, Hitwise?
2007, and it was the largest ever exit of a venture-backed startup in Australia, $240 million.
Started by
Adrian Giles and Andrew Barlow.
I know Adrian well, fantastic. Run by Andrew Walsh, one of the best people in the whole ecosystem.
It's an absolute dream team if you look at who was involved in that.
One of the best, but one of the nicest as well.
Yeah. One of the nicest, and Tessa Court, who went on to do her own stuff. Yeah.
She's actually built an incredible business intelligence bank that raised a large chunk of coin from Five Elms over in the US. Oh, really?
Do you work with them? Is that why you're giving her
No. Tessa's a good friend of mine. No, but I think we were lucky. Like, we built a business before social media. I remember when I was overseas once on one of my many trips every year, and I got home, my wife said to me, "Oh, there's this amazing website. It's called Facebook. Have you ever heard of it?" Right? This is how early it was. I'm like, "Well, yeah, we do the ratings on the internet, and we rank all these websites." The third website in Australia at the time. But that's how, we were shipping, servers around the world. We had our own purpose-built data center where we were bringing Dell servers in and racking them up here in St Kilda Road. I mean, you'd never do that. I mean, in Blackbird's first ever fund, their 2012 fund, which has been a huge success, and we've spoken, we know about that, obviously. Yeah.
Has it been a success? I've never heard that.
In their opening sentence, they listed Atlassian, Hitwise, and a few others as what they aspire to invest in terms of the next generation of startups. I was running an offsite the other day with one of the companies that I advise, and there were a couple of different age demographics there. So I'm in my mid-40s, there are a few in their mid-30s, a few in their mid-20s, and we're talking about three different decades. And so some of these people are like, "I'm so deep in the tech industry now, I joined in 2018 I'm like, far out,
And there's so much money now. There was no money. I mean, there was back in those days, Allen and Buckeridge, weren't they in?
They were one of the
original VCs, they were. Maybe they like were. Yeah. And so
they were on the documents.
You should ask Gavin some other stuff. Do you want to ask?
I just want to ask. So one of the things that I think probably the question I get most from founders is, how do I raise capital? Should I raise capital? I think part of you've got the Square Peg experience as well, so you've been on both sides of it. Is a lot of what you do, or a big chunk of what you do, creating the decks, knowing who to speak to, having your Rolodex. How much does the capital raising part factor into what you do at Ignition versus the operational chops that you bring? How do you split?
So we're not corporate advisors. We don't go out there and raise money and take a 6% clip or whatever. We don't do any of that stuff. Investment and how should we capitalize our business is certainly a very important topic that we discuss with our founders. A lot of the work we do is operational. So go to market, commercialization, product strategy. It plays from all different parts of our careers. The investment side of things is, what is the best way for us to be able to scale this? Should we continue to bootstrap it? Should we raise external capital? And now in 2023, there's lots of different avenues to be able to raise. There's revenue-based finance, there's venture debt.
We can just say debt. Debt. Why don't we say debt?
Debt.
You can go and get debt.
This is what Matt does at Tractor.
Yeah, so there's Tractor Ventures, there's Partners for Growth, there's Lighter Capital. So there are alternative
avenues.
Partners
for Growth, which is John Georgiadis.
Jason and Carthy.
So I remember I met Jason, I think it's maybe pretty early when he came to Australia. So I think He has been a trailblazer in setting up that industry in Australia. And the stories that I've heard about how he treated the founders that he lent to when they were going through hardship recently have all been incredibly kind and positive. Not what I would have expected from a lender, frankly.
Well, can you just go back and say, how does... Because people, a lot of people aren't as sophisticated as you are, dear. So how does debt work? So most people go and raise equity. So you might raise a convertible note, which is sort of a bit of debt, a bit of equity, straight equity, could be pref shares.
Selling shares, we could say. Raising equity, selling shares.
Sell shares.
So if you're valued at $8 million and you raise $2 million in cash, your post-money valuation's $10 million, the investors own 20% of the company. So that's pretty straightforward. That's an equity round. A debt round, Adir is probably going to be able to provide a much more sophisticated version of this, but a debt, you end up paying, it's a loan, so you end up paying interest, and some of the venture debt providers also take warrants. And so, you know, for
and why would
equity.
Someone, if you're a startup...
We can say warrants. I'm going to just explain things. So warrants basically is like an option to buy shares at a later date at some price,
yeah,
usually.
These organizations want some upside as well. They don't just want their interest. They want the outsized returns as well. It may not be as skewed as a venture capital firm, but they want some of the
upside.
So
you're taking this debt, and usually debt has got all sorts of... We talked last week about covenants, promises that you make, and like you can lose your pants if you don't keep the promises. And so this venture debt, instead of taking your pants... to protect their downside, they give themselves more upside. That's the way they offset their risk. And the upside is usually they can buy some piece of the company at some pre-agreed price as well as getting their money back.
Correct. And when you're looking at a growth round, so not a pre-seed or a pre-seed these days or whatever you want to bloody label yeah. these things, when you're doing a growth round, often a Partners for Growth will come up and provide venture debt alongside an equity round. So you'll do it in combination so the founders don't have to dilute as much and the shareholders don't have to dilute.
Is there a point where it's too early to get venture debt that you risk the company's solvency and
well, pre-revenue, you can't get venture debt. I mean, you need to be generating revenue.
Oh, let's forget about pre-revenue.
Yeah, I mean, the venture debt providers, they do their DD as well, right? Yeah. Obviously, they don't want to lose their pants. They don't want to lose their money. So they're doing their own due diligence to ensure that the mechanics of the business, the unit economics and other things are sound.
Are you able to tell some of the businesses you've worked with over the journey who have been the best success stories? How did you help them?
You give us your top three.
Yeah,
I know, this is because this is now going to... What we've asked him to do is to alienate the bulk of his client base. But that's okay, because that's not our problem.
Yeah, that's right. So look, one of the ones that hold close to my heart is a company called Carbon. They're in the accounting industry, practice management software for accountants, global business. Stuart McLeod was one of the co-founders. Ian Vaccine and John Freeman are the other two co-founders. Stu's a rock star. I started working with him actually the day after I left SquarePeg. I picked up the phone and I said, I'm going to come and work for you. And that was when the business was pretty much a blank sheet of paper, pre-revenue, pre-customers.
Wow.
Now they're valued well over $100 million. They've raised, tens of millions, I think.
More. This is $100 million ARR?
No. The valuation.
Oh, valuation,
well,
sorry.
Over $100 million US dollars. Their ARRs, they've got staff all over the world now. It's a brilliant business and an exciting business as well. You know, true B2B SaaS, right? So these businesses are delightful businesses.
Primed to lose money for the next 10 years before. I know that world.
Well, the interesting
B2B
thing
SaaS.
With those guys, they raised their seed round from Blackbird Ventures as well as a number of family businesses. Their Series A was led by Five Elms as well, the company mm-hmm. that Tessa's company took some money from. And then their Series B was led by Tidemark, who's Dave Yuan, who's ex-TCV, who did the deal, the Series A in SiteMinder and also in Xero as well. So if you look at that kind of stack of investor base, they've got a high-quality investor.
Just on that, how important is the quality of investors? So when you're speaking to the founders you work with, is it more important simply to get cash in the door? Let's forget terms for now, because we've talked about terms, and assume there's no dodgy prefs, three times liquidation prefs. Everybody's offering similar kind of money.
Friendly money,
and it's good money. And how important, let's say you've got a really well-known firm offering $10 million at 50, and you've got a less well-known firm offering $15 million at $80 million valuation. What do you counsel your founders to take?
I remember Tony Holt at SquarePeg said something to me, and it always stuck with me. He said, if the founder wants to set the valuation, let me set the terms.
Yeah.
So valuation's kind of a mystical thing. Valuation doesn't really mean much if the terms aren't very founder friendly. Look, reputation is everything in this market. As you guys know, FOMO as well is rampant through the venture capital industry. So There is definitely something to say about top tier VCs and brand name VCs versus second tier and third tier VCs. You're going to get to a point as a founder, if you can't get the tier one brand names, and we're talking about the Blackbirds and Squarepegs and Airtrees of the world, then you need money to scale your business if you are on the drip of venture capital money.
I actually question what, digressing, what's, let's look at, you look at, obviously Blackbird and Airtree have the biggest funds and Squarepeg, biggest funds, very good.
Where's this going?
But if you look at like a, call it an Our Innovation Fund, probably has the best returns. Do you take an OIF over a Blackbird?
Look, for me, like if I was scaling a startup business today, I'd be looking at the partners and the humans behind the fund and say, what culture do they have? How do they treat the founders in good times and bad times? I would do my due diligence on them. A lot of founders, they, you know, a lot of the mentoring that we provide and coaching we provide founders is they get intimidated by saying, we're going to go and meet with Our Innovation Fund or Airtree or whatever, and they're shitting themselves, right? And so what we need to tell them is they're just humans at the other end.
Yeah.
And yes, they've got the checkbook, but there is certainly this dominance kind of, or you know, hierarchy between the people with the checkbook and the people who don't. We advise the founders that they should do as much of the questioning in those meetings as the investors are, because this is a 10 to 12 year journey. Back at Hipwise days, the average length from founding to exit was 7 to 9 years, and now we're 11 to 13 because of the flood of cash into the market.
I think Our Innovation Fund is excellent. I mean, that's David Shane that is behind there, who's and successful and mentoring and good to deal with and very smart. And the other one, I think, the other one that I think is amazing, do you know what I'm going to say?
Equity Venture Partners. Howard and the team there.
Well, Les is probably Les Zekely, best startup investor in Australia.
The best angel by the Richard Goyder style length
by
of Australia.
By infinity, let's call it. Yes,
he
I
was
agree.
Obviously SiteMinder. He was he's in Blue Thumb.
Resdy as well.
Yeah, Resdy.
No, he's everything. Let me tell you one thing about valuation. So I want to. Let me give you another moron moment of my personal career. So I used to think that the quality of the business I ran from an ego point of view was linked to how many employees I had. It's one of the dumbest thoughts that you could ever have. Now I want
It's almost the opposite.
Oh, I mean, it was unbelievably dumb. And so I learned that lesson. And so I think valuation, the link between valuation and founder ego is as strong as I felt about employee numbers, and also as dumb. It is such a dumb thing to hang your ego hat on.
Remember when Susan Wu was running Stripe in Australia in the early days, another client that we worked with back in their entry into the Australian market? You can weave that one in.
Is Susan still in Australia?
No, I haven't seen her for a while. So I remember I was talking to her in one of our meetings about Stripe and stuff like that, and she's like, so what are some companies that you know you guys invested in when you were at Squarepeg and this, that, and the other? And I mentioned Vend, and I'm like, they're gunning it. They're hiring people all over the world and everything. And her response was, headcount is no measure of success. Right? And then you look at the WhatsApp exit, and they had you know sub 20 employees or however many.
I mean,
it was.
It's sub 10. I think Susan, speaking of great investors, Susan Wu was early in Twitter, and she was one of the first checks into Stripe. So she'd have to be one of the greatest angel investors globally.
And I have a feeling that I told this story to someone the other day. I have a feeling she was in the VC room when Dropbox pitched for their Series A, where, you know, a lot of founders, here's a tip for founders who are listening to this. You know, there are so many founders who go and pitch for money, but they use a pitch deck and not their product. You know, that infuriates me. I think, you know, like nearly every founder would do that, right? And I believe that the story goes that with Dropbox, they had two computers open and they dragged one file from the desktop into the cloud folder and it appeared on the other computer and the deal was done.
When I go around with Catapult, I always take one of the physical devices to all investors. They all want to touch it and hold it and whatever, and suddenly, you know, it's tangible and they have a different view. I want you to ask Gavin some questions that he can answer in one sentence.
Well, can we skip two and three just really quickly? Second and third.
Well, favorite. Stripe was a huge So we work with Stripe. We helped them secure their first 20 enterprise customers. Yeah. I mean, that was a long time ago. We don't do that often for founders today. But certainly for founders that we work with and we believe in their product, you know, introducing them to our network for partnerships or customers and stuff like that is certainly very important. Other companies we work with, the company I don't know what company we work with, MyDeal, you know, Sean at MyDeal.
Yeah, it's one of the great exits in Australian retail online retail history.
Yeah,
on the sell side
certainly. Was it Woolworths who bought that, who just smoked
230 million or something?
Paul Greenberg as chairman, probably the nicest person in Australian tech,
in online tech.
In Australian tech, and basically was a big part of Afterpay getting moving, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But because everybody likes him so much and he knows everyone, he could literally take Afterpay just to meet merchants. Like, it's pretty incredible.
Yeah, he ran this great, I think he still runs NORA, so National Online Retail Association. He had this great conference in, I think it was about 2016. I went along as like probably like the smallest person who was invited. There was, Gabby was his peak then. It was a Versace, remember Versace was amazing. It's now called the Imperial. It's almost escaped as we speak. Yeah. And Gabby was there and Jamie Jackson was there. No, Carl Jackson was there, who was running MySale, Ozsale, which was a $500 million business at the time. Like Peter Birtles, who was running Super Retail, was there. It was just unbelievable. The people he got to this Versace, I remember my favorite part of it, and you got some pretty, they had like proper sessions. You know, when you sit in these sessions, they're all super boring. You had all these, obviously, these dot-com guys in the sessions and girls in the sessions. And we were looking at, you know, Versace's got that massive lagoon pool. I turn around and so we're having this serious session. Someone's taking it. And Gabby's doing laps.
Oh, that's, the Versace, I mean, I'm so unsurprised to hear that story.
He just could not have cared less about, and he was right, because the whole session was obviously a waste of time. But he's Gabby doing laps of this pool. One of these indelible moments that I can recall.
I'm not staying at that hotel, by the way. I didn't stay when it was Versace because, I mean,
I think it's 999, three nights, 999, luxuryescapes.com. That's pretty good.
No, it's a great deal. You know what my only issue with that hotel is? It's on the Gold Coast and it has no connection to the beach. It's not, you can't even see the beach.
Great pool, though.
Yeah, a great pool.
Very few hotels have. There's Langham and Sheraton about the only ones with beachfront.
Well, I wouldn't book the Langham either, by the way.
Langham's, that was one of our best ever sellers, actually.
Oh, I'm not surprised people book it. That has got, that pool is too small for the size of hotel.
The hotel is like next level.
What if I say this, though? If you are going to book the old Versace, which is called the what? Imperial.
Imperial now.
Or if you're going to book it, you'd be crazy not to book it through Luxury Escapes.
Thanks, Adair.
There you go.
You would be, actually. But yeah. So back to obviously our guest who's coming not to hear about Luxury Escapes.
Always happy to hear about Luxury Escapes.
Adair, this is actually a question from Adair. He's asked me to ask. What do you think the world's most overvalued loss-making tech company is right now? I've got mine, but let's hear yours.
That's a very... Adair did see this question with me. It's a very Adair question. So I want to take it up a level and talk about something a little bit more controversial than that, which is Tiger Global and the mad rush of 2021. So looking at VC portfolios being overvalued because they deployed so much capital in 2021. And what are they going to do in 2022 and beyond to be able to bring those NAVs back into... or NAV, net asset value statements, back into reality. And you know, Tiger raised, I think it was $12.5 billion in late 2021, deployed the whole thing before it even closed, and then were down 20% on paper. And I think they devalued their statement, you know, every month throughout 2022. So for me, rather than an individual, I think the VCs who deployed at rapid pace through that period are going to find a lot of hurt over the next couple of years.
So you know what's interesting? So I, like, my conflict disclosure is I've got money in that Tiger fund. I think it's $8 billion or something. Or something.
I think that was
like
the one before the $12 billion. They did a couple that year.
I can tell you the hits that I'm in. Milk Run, that's in that fund. Yep. So that's what I'm in. So I'm actually losing money.
Done well there.
Mr. Yum. Yep. And so I'm sure I can't talk to... So I get their updates constantly. So I'm sure I can't talk about them because they'll have me shot. But
Trade Square,
yeah.
That's Natty's business, right?
That's
that he's running from Cyprus.
Yeah, well, Carfi's luck, right? Yeah. So definitely that's a win for him out of that. And so it'll be interesting to see. I think I'm a believer in Tiger fundamentally. Like, I think if you had to pick a global manager that has proven to be smart consistently over time, and, you know, like Jason Lenger used to work for them.
But how much was Tiger Lee Fixall, who obviously left to study? And as soon as Lee left, suddenly Tiger wasn't doing so well. Correlation.
Well, we don't know how well it's going to do because it's early since he left, right? They've just deployed capital.
It's been four years.
So let's let this stuff come through. What I think is this. I can say this about Tiger without them shooting me, I think. Okay? You'll know. I mean, if I'm not at the next podcast, you'll know what happened. So basically... I think they've been quite honest from what I've seen in what they send me in writing down their investments. They've been pretty honest in it. They've written off some investments. They've also had some exits that have kind of offset the write-offs. So I think definitely there was a lot of investment at crazy valuations at the top of the market. But of all of the funds that I think will end up being okay through it, I reckon Tiger is the best chance. I think all of the other funds and what that, because it's so broad.
You're talking global funds, or yeah. So is it the SoftBanks and the
Insights? Yeah, because it's so broad. Like, I don't know how many are on that piece of paper in that portfolio, but it's like dozens, and it might be hundreds.
They got to a pace of investing where it was almost a deal a day in 2021.
Yeah. And so I think, given the nature of VC investment, which, you know, they use all this fancy power law and all this stuff, right?
Yeah.
But what they mean is you just need a few mega wins and the losses don't matter. That's what they mean.
It's very dartboard investing.
Yeah, well, we can have that right? I think it might be blindfolded darts.
Certainly in that time, I mean, they pushed up the pace of investing. The valuation skyrocketed because of their behaviours, and everybody else kind of got sucked into the wake behind them.
And so I might just be saying this so I feel better about the money that I deployed, but I think that the breadth of their investments might carry them through a decent return. But I'll tell you, I'll say this. I like the way you say, I told you to ask that question, as if I'm shy to speak. I like that.
I don't think anyone here is shy to speak.
So what about this, though? You know, Blackbird talks about their 2012 fund. SquarePeg talks about their fund zero. You think we're ever going to see those returns again from VC funds in Australia?
How about Blackbird, even less Canberra? Would you say that we would see those returns?
You need to strike gold a large number of times in a very short period of time for all these VC funds to get that type of return in this current climate.
I think we're out of time, but we'll just really quickly go to Goyder Watch, because obviously it's our famous bet. My mum actually sent me this message saying, I think you might win the bet with our deer with something about Goyder during the week. But sadly,
Your family is overconfident, including you.
I think Goyder's digging his heels in. Like, his latest excuse yesterday was, or a couple of days ago, was they can't get rid of me because we just got rid of the CEO and there'd be too much turmoil. When the only reason they got rid of the CEO was because the chairman was inept and let the CEO run rampshot and destroy the business and take it from the second most loved company to the third most hated company. And that's his reason for staying on. He did such a bad job running the business as chairman that you can't move, you've got a new CEO. So that's why he's digging his heels
in. I told you that would be one of the... I said plot armor. I told you last week or whatever it was. I've got... This is my new theory on this, okay? So do you know that there's... I don't often talk about bombs on this podcast. Do you know there's a bomb called Moab? Have you ever heard of that bomb? Mother of all bombs. It's actually called... I think it's called Massive Ordnance Air Blast or something, right? It's this huge thing, and like they dropped it on some tunnels or something in Afghanistan, and like you didn't want to be in the tunnels when they dropped the bomb, okay? It's this huge bomb. Okay? And so...
shouldn't laugh.
And so this is what I think about that. Richard Goyder... You are not going to kill him with small arms fire, okay? Like, you can put him to a Senate committee. He's too sophisticated. That's just small arms fire. You're not going to penetrate the bunker.
Is he sophisticated? I don't think he's sophisticated.
No, I think he is. And so
he's a little accountant.
Did you see his performance at the Senate committee?
I wasn't overly impressed by it.
I thought he did well at that thing. And so basically, he's in his bunker, and you're not going to penetrate it with small arms fire. Unless someone goes and drops the Moab on him, I think he's going to be fine. And I don't see any Moab coming over the hill that is, like, there have been so many things that have landed on that business. None of them have penetrated his bunker. I think it's going to take something surprising out of left field if he's going to go. And I told you, every week that passes, I am more and more confident that he's going to survive. And if he really does have shareholders on his side, which he says he does, he said it at the Senate committee.
He claims.
Well, but he said it at a Senate committee. Yeah. And presumably if he would have said it at a Senate committee and it was not true,
saying he's lying. I'm sure there's probably hundreds of shareholders in Qantas. You only need one of them, two of them to claim out the claim true.
But if the instos were not supporting him, like, you know, there were instos that come out and publicly supported. So
there's that one guy. That guy should be sacked, incidentally. Crispin, whatever his name is, Crispin.
That Pendle, you mean?
Yeah, the Pendle guy.
Yeah.
I think that the biggest question is who's... Because, and Joe talked about it this week, the board is so terrible there that there's no one to replace him. The only people who really can't be blamed for the last 8 years is that guy who ran American Airlines, and it dropped 75%. He shouldn't have been on the board. This guy's not capable of chairing anything, Doug Park or whatever his name is. There's no one else who's even capable of chairing that business. They've got to get someone. Tom Sampson, the T-shirt guy, he's got to go. He's short as you can suppose.
T-shirt guy.
They've got to bring in
You're much more negative about the board than I am.
This is the worst board Australia's ever seen, almost, I think. Like, your mate Maxine on there, and there's that idiot who was on the Rio Tinto board when they blew up the mine. Like, that guy who was a Michael
I think
Strange,
you're too like, hard on boards. Maybe I say that because I'm self-interested. And
I'm not hard on the Catapult board. That's
no,
a great board.
I know, but some people are hard on the Catapult board. Like, it is not easy being, I know this is going to sound like a play the smallest violin in sympathy comment, but it's not easy being a director, an independent, non-executive director on a public company. Like, you know, it's hard to get visibility on stuff. You're heavily reliant on management. There's a fine balance between trying to make sure that you're, like Qantas is a governance heavy board because of a big company. There's a fine balance between doing that and holding management accountable, but not not ending up trying to run the company on behalf of management, which makes good leaders quit. Like, I think it's a harder job than you acknowledge with those comments. And that, I'm not saying the Qantas board has done a good job. I think they've done a terrible job not holding a CEO accountable who spent a period of time being a really good CEO and now has trashed the brand. I think Qantas will be fine in 6 months. I honestly do. I think it will be fine in 6 months. The new CEO will clean it up. She'll be able to make all these decisions that Joyce wasn't prepared to make. Like, I think it'll be fine in 6 months.
They can improve from a customer, and they will improve customer-wise. The challenge, that's costly, though. And then you got fuel prices. So the Qantas share price is way lower than it was in 2007. That's 16 years ago. There's been a little bit of dividend along the way, but this is... People say how great Alan Joyce and Goyder have been for shareholders. Well, not really, given you could have put your money in an index fund and probably 4X'd it. So this has been a disaster. Disaster for shareholders, disaster for customers, disaster for employees. It's been a disaster for everyone. And the board has sat above them. Like, you can forgive one or two mistakes. Like, everybody makes mistakes. I make mistakes. Everybody. But the number of mistakes compounding, we're talking, they made like 30 to 40 bad mistakes on that board. That's unforgivable.
Mm. Well... We'll agree to do. Like, I don't know. I didn't keep a tally of the number of mistakes.
I made the 30-40 up, but it must be that.
My clicker. I didn't have the clicker. You know, like the
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. But
as a customer of their frequent flyer account and flew Qantas all over the world every year for so many years, they're worthless these days.
Yeah,
you can't even get a bloody flight on.
That's mistake 31.
It's bad. We all think it's bad to be a customer. We all think it should be easier to use frequent flyer points. We all think that they've been slow upgrading their hard product on their planes. It's non-competitive with international airlines. That's all true. By the way, they're competing against state-funded airlines in a lot of cases. Yep. So, you know, although we say they're the spirit of Australia, which is, by the way, they've broken
They have been state-funded, $2.7 billion during COVID.
So all right. Yes, that is true. But they're not state-funded the way Emirates is state-funded or Qatar or whatever it is. So, like, I don't think it's not an easy gig running an airline. It might be the worst gig of just about any company. And I think, yes, it sucks to be a customer of Qantas. Now, I told you I barely fly them, but I fly them enough to keep my platinum status. But I think it will be better in 6 months. I think they'll fix it up in 6 months. It won't be an enjoyable time to be an executive in the company over the next
actually,
6 months.
Actually, the challenges, or not challenges, of running an airline, but Bruce Buchanan, who's the CEO of Rokt, was one of the first CEOs of Jetstar.
He was a second, after Alan Joyce.
Well,
you know why he's so enthusiastic about Rokt, Gavin? Because I think you probably invested
in
when you were at SquarePay.
Yeah. Series A. Yeah, I was on their board for it.
You've got to know, we are very naive guys, Adam, but when you've got a high-quality operator like Gavin in the room who can weave in his successes in every conversation, exactly. This is someone you can learn from.
I think Bruce Buchanan is probably the best CEO Australia's ever produced, actually. Rokt is like a $3 billion business.
You only put people at plus or minus 3 standard deviations on the curve. Either they're the best ever or the worst sport ever. There is just no middle ground.
There's a lot of black and white with me.
No.
certainly while I was on the board and while I was still at SquarePeg, his communication was next level. You know, the depth of communication, the frequency of communication was fantastic. And I remember Matt Rockman saying to me while he was living over in LA in Hollywood land, was saying to me, a good CEO is a good communicator, doesn't hide anything along the way and the like. And now that was when the business was $50 million. So.
Yeah. Matt being the third and sometimes forgotten founder of Seek.
Not forgotten to me.
People that know him, but just in general, people say the Bassett
not a Bassett.
Brothers.
Yeah.
Well, coming up next month is South by Southwest in Sydney. Yeah. The first time it's come out from Austin, coming to Sydney, and Paul and Andrew Bassett are doing an On the Couch together, talking about the journey of Seek, and now they're kind of side by side with $1 billion-plus funds at Seek Investments and at SquarePeg, and Dan Kras is interviewing them on the couch.
I think more importantly, I'm being interviewed by Ed Cowan, who's the biggest shareholder in Rokt for South by Southwest. So,
are you
with Lucy Liu from Airwalk? Oh,
I wasn't going to go to South by Southwest in Sydney.
It looks great. I think it's a great lineup.
You know what? I've got a bad attitude towards things in general. I look at these things and I'm cynical.
It's a week-long junket.
No, I know, but like, yeah, but no one's going to pay for my junk. And who's paying for you? You're going to pay for me?
No, I'll points.
I'll go and be a luxury escapes ambassador. How about that?
No, we should do a pod from up
I'm
there.
I'm happy to be a contrarian ambassador for you guys. We can get a media pass.
Adam just said we should do a pod from up there. By the way, I've been advocating for a live podcast.
We'll do a live podcast.
It's hard to get him across the line.
Yeah, live podcast would be very good.
He's getting upset because we've talked for so long.
I think Paul Keelan's going to have a big job editing this one. So I think we'll call it a day. Thanks, Gavin, for coming in for our very first ever guest. You've been fantastic. Much better than us. Great to see you again, dear. We'll keep track of Richard Goiter, and hopefully next week he's no longer around.
Hopefully he is.
Thanks, guys.
And we'll wrap up the episode there. Look forward to seeing you all next week. As always, a big thanks to our incredible sponsors, Bench Media, Remont Advisory, and Bowden Financial, for making the show happen. Thank you for listening to The Contrarians with Adam and Adir. If you want to submit a question for the show, please send a voice recording to Adam J. Schwab at Instagram. Today's show was produced by Keelan Brown. Make sure you subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss an episode. And don't forget to give us a rating and tell your friends.